Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Today, as we mark the Veterans Day holiday, we want to take some time to consider writing about war. Although Walt Whitman concluded during the Civil War that, quote, the real war will never get in the books, many writers try and arguably succeed in using words to work through what happens on the battlefield. Joining us for this conversation is Robert Pinsky, former Poet Laureate of the U.S. and the director of the Creative Writing Program at Boston University. Thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here.
Also with us by phone, Brian Turner. He served in the U.S. Army for 7 years. His poetry has been shortlisted for the T.S. Eliot Prize. Brian, welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, it's great to be here with you, Deborah and Robert.
Hi, Brian.
Hey, good to hear you.
And listeners, we want you to join in this conversation on this Veterans Day holiday. Do you have a favorite essay, poem, writing about war? Are you remembering someone this Veterans Day with a particular piece of writing? And if you are a veteran, has writing or poetry helped you process your experiences? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. And I guess I want to start with kind of a broad question, Robert Pinsky, of finding beauty in tragedy. Right, in poetry, beautiful words to describe the violence of war. How do you put those two things together?
Poetry offers a human scale. And war, beginning in this country with the Civil War, which was the first really recognized high technology war, the mass scale of the killing and the suffering, the impersonality of it, and the stupidity of it, the senselessness, all are in contrast to the idea of an art that is based on one human voice. So it's not just words. It's that single person. And when I think of the best-known poetry about war, one is very aware that the perspective is human. The scale is particular. So even if you're describing some of the most horrible things you can imagine, it isn't so much the beauty as the dignity, let's say, of one person speaking.
Right. So tell me, what are some of the most well-known writings about war that you think we should, that should be considered essential writing when you're describing this senselessness of the human experience?
I'll name a prose work first. Ulysses Grant's memoirs give us the voice of someone who knows how to make sense out of war, as an expert at how much material has to be where, how the weather affects it, how the roads affect it, and how human personality affects it. And at the same time, he has a lot of insight into personalities. So you know which general is good but slow, which one is fast but a little crazy. And his grief for the deaths and his unforgettable contempt and anger at Nathan Forrest and the slaughter at Pillow Hill. It's a good counterpart to the poetry of Whitman about the war. Hmm. And it anticipates the war that one of the things they say about the First World War is it never ended. Mm-hmm. He anticipates that never-ending First World War, which can't be made sense of and which kept seeming to keep going of its own weight without anyone willing it to keep going. And in that sense, he anticipates the American voice of Whitman, but also the great World War One poets who died in that war, like Wilfred Owen. Sassoon Owen's, in a way, his mentor, didn't die in the war. But those, and in my own generation, Yusuf Komeniaka, who's a veteran of Vietnam, wrote a poem called Facing It that a lot of people know and love.
Right. Well, I'm wondering if we maybe go back first instead of going to your generation. Maybe we go back to World War One first.
Yes.
And the Wilfred Owen poem "Dulce et Decorum Est," which is considered one of the famous
yes.
poems about war. I'm wondering if you could read a little bit of that.
Sure. "Dulce et Decorum Est," bent double like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed. Coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge till on the haunting flares we turned our backs and toward our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched asleep. Many had lost their boots but limped on, bloodshod. All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots of tired, outstripped 5-9s that dropped behind. Gas! Gas, quick boys, an ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. But someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light as under a green sea, I saw him drowning. In all my dreams, before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. If in sonic smothering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face like a devil sick of sin, if you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues, my friend, you would not talk with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory, the old lie, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori.
Hmm.
Those last words in Latin are from the Latin poet Horace, and in a way it's no fair on Horace. If you actually read that Horace ode, Horace, unlike poets like poor Rupert Brooke, who we all deride and deplore because he wrote nationalistic poems about that war, Horace, in the context of what he's saying how arbitrary it all is. Mm. It's a poem, if you read the poem in David Ferry's or Robert Hass's translation, Horace is closer to Wilfred Owen than it seems. I think Wilfred Owen is thinking more of kind of jingoistic, nationalistic, chauvinist, often ruling class propaganda about the glory of war.
Mm.
And it's not a poem one forgets.
Mm. I want to bring Brian Turner into the conversation a bit. Brian, do you remember this poem by Wilfred Owen? You remember the first time you heard it and how it may have affected you?
I think I did in high school. I was in AP English class with Mrs. Grupa's AP English class, I believe. But
I guess you remember.
Yeah, over the years, it's stuck with me and sort of become more and more layered. I guess to add to some of what Robert's saying there, for me in that point when it says, as under a green sea, I saw him drowning. And then earlier it says, a little bit later it says, if in some smothering dreams you two could pace behind the that rhetorical move, if in some smothering dreams you two, as if, Wilfred knows that we aren't there, and there's that distance that's recognized, and yet through language I feel like he's pulled us very close to, our boots aren't quite in the mud, but I feel very close to this moment. It's as close as I can come to recognizing something my great-grandfather might have witnessed as he was gassed in France. And it took years for the gas to kill him, but in 1932 it finally did.
Mm-hmm. Brian, I want to ask you about why you've decided to use poetry to describe war. Is it, like Robert Pinsky says, trying to make sense of some of the senselessness of war and using language to do that? But before I do, I want to make sure I remind our listeners that you are invited to join this conversation and share with us your favorite writings about war. You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. So, Brian Turner, why? Why use poetry to describe what happens on the battlefield?
For me, I think initially I wrote poems while I was a sergeant in Iraq, and I wrote them in my notebooks. And usually I start off just writing journal entries, and then a couple of lines of poems would, of a poem would appear, and I'd recognize it. I'd written poetry for years before that. And then I put it into another notebook and continued to work on them. I couldn't have answered that question, I don't think, if you'd asked me at the time. But looking back, I think it's because I couldn't see a narrative or a through line to the whole thing. I couldn't see the sort of prosaic, discursive sort of wandering through a set of ideas. It seemed very disparate sort of moments would happen, and in between that was the through line was sort of boredom and emptiness, and then some crazy event would happen, or 24 hours of an event, or 30 seconds of it, and then back to boredom again. And so poetry seemed, because I wasn't high up the food chain, I wasn't a general or something like that who could see, you know, the large-scale movements on a map of the political events that were taking place. I was deep down inside of a war, just in one period of a war, and poetry seemed a vehicle that helped me to say what couldn't be said any other way.
Mm. You also have a poem called Eulogy about one of your fellow soldiers who died in Iraq. Just tell us a little bit about this poem.
Well, I think the poem, you know, it does the work itself, but maybe outside of the poem. When I came home, this was the one. I was invited to go to Germany at one point to read, and they only wanted, they flew me from California there, and they just wanted me to read one poem. And so it had to be this one.
Hmm.
And part of the reason for that was that when my unit came back from Iraq, we were out on a parade field, and the colonel gave a speech at one point, and during his speech, he listed the names of those who did not come back with us. And I was listening to that list of names, and then Private Miller's didn't appear. And it seemed like he'd been, to me, it seemed like he'd been erased. And so it became a very kind of political thing for me. I felt like there was an American citizen who deserved to have his name spoken among the dead, you know. And
the reason it wasn't included?
Sure. Eulogy. It happens on a Monday at 11:20 a.m. as tower guards eat sandwiches and seagulls drift by on the Tigris River. Prisoners tilt their heads to the west, though burlap sacks and duct tape blind them. The sound reverberates down concertina coils the way piano wire thrums when given slack, and it happens like this on a blue day of sun when Private Miller pulls the trigger to take brass and fire into his mouth. The sound lifts the birds up off the water. A mongoose pauses under the orange trees, and nothing can stop it now. No matter what blur of motion surrounds him, no matter what voices crackle over the radio in static confusion, because if only for this moment the earth is stilled, and Private Miller has found what low hush there is down in the eucalyptus shade there by the river.
Hmm. That's very beautiful, Brian, very beautiful.
Well, you know, part of the reason I stopped reading it for a time because it felt like, as I continued to read, I had to bring Private Miller back to life and then kind of kill him again every time I read the poem. And after a couple of years, I got really so tired of that whole process, and it just seemed unhealthy, you know. So I stopped reading that poem. And then I was in Broward County, and I was at a veterans event on a day like today or yesterday, and the suicide rate was brought up during that time. Mm-hmm. It astounded me. And I started doing the math on it and thinking about the losses of the wars that we've been a part of during all of our lifetimes. And it seems that when we're talking about, you know, oftentimes wars are given by historians, they're given these tombstones with the number of dead on them and when the war was born and when it finished, you know, the year that the war was over. But the wars, all the historians are wrong, and the wars outlive the books that they're put in.
I want to bring some callers into the conversation before we run out of time. Brian is calling from Hyde Park. Brian, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to suggest the book Fear by Gabriel Chevalier, which was published in French about World War I, an autobiographical novel that was written, finished before World War II, but then the author was too depressed to actually publish it. It's only recently been available, and it's just a striking and horrible confirmation of war as fought by lions and led by donkeys, which is how I feel about most conflicts, including Vietnam, where my father was killed. He was an officer, but he identified with the he identified with the donkeys.
Hmm. So the book Fear, Brian, thanks so much for that recommendation. Are you familiar with that, Robert Pinsky? No. Brian Turner, are you familiar with that?
No, yeah, I was going to suggest maybe Hassan Blasim, the corpse exhibition. And, you know, we're getting, I'm grateful for Brian's suggestion. I'm going to read that book. But one of the things from the war in Iraq and Afghanistan now, these wars were beginning to get children who lived through them, you know, and are writing in Arabic or other languages, and they're being translated now. We can start getting voices from the war that know much more about the war than I can speak to.
I want to bring someone else into the conversation. Michael is calling from Somerville. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Michael. I heard someone mention that they heard that piece they were talking about in an AP English class, and I heard a poem. It's called The Diameter of the Bomb. He's an Israeli poet named, I'm going to mispronounce his name, but Yehuda Amachi.
Amachai.
Amazing how
Amachai. Robert Pinsky knows this.
Yeah, it's a beautiful poem.
It's amazing how those poems stay with us years after we read them, you know, at a glance in English class. And I don't know anyone that's ever served, and I've never served myself, but the way they can put us into conflict and make us feel like we've really experienced it years later, it's amazing.
Well, Michael,
say that. Thanks.
Michael, I wonder, what message do you think you took from that still resonates with you, that made you remember it?
Well, the thing is the poem was about war, and it was about how the diameter of the bomb impacts people globally. It doesn't just impact the people that are directly involved in the conflict. One of the lines is, you know, the person mourning the death of the girl on a distant land across the ocean. And I think any time there's something bad that happens in the world, whether it's a shooting or if it's just maybe a mean comment someone makes to another person, that gets transferred to another person, and that gets transferred to another person. And one bad thing can impact everyone in the world. You know, on the flip side, one good thing can impact everyone in the world. It's amazing how, like it says in the poem, the diameter of the bomb was 7 meters. It's, you know, its effective range, 7 meters. But it ends up impacting everyone. And then the last line, and most of all, the orphans whose cries go all the way up to heaven, making a circle with no end and no God. Mm. And it's, you know, one bad act is, you know, infinite. It propagates infinitely. One good thing can propagate infinitely. And I just love that.
All right. Thanks so much for your call. I'm wondering, Brian Turner, can we ask you, give us a work that you recommend on this Veterans Day for folks to reflect?
Well, if I follow the last caller's his impulse there, then I would suggest, because oftentimes we look to writers who are inside wars, like Michael Hare, Dispatches, for example, beautiful book. But I'd also recommend something like Siobhan Fallon, who's a spouse of a military service member. She wrote a novel called You Know When the Men Are Gone. And there's a new wave of writers that are coming now that are connected to military service in different ways, and we have a lot to learn from them. They've been kind of in silence for decades, as the veterans have spoken.
Well, that makes a perfect segue into someone who's waiting to get in on this conversation and weigh in a bit. Tom Lasser was in the Army for 6 years, and he leads a veterans writing workshop at Salem State University. Tom, I'm wondering, what work or works do you put on your list of writing about war?
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. Mm. In the last year, I really recommend Company K by William March. I feel that he wrote sort of these little vignettes from the perspective of every person in this one company in World War I. And it's a fantastic book that we have been covering over the last year, since it is the 100-year anniversary of Armistice Day. And what we really find in this work is that there are some segments that could have happened in Iraq or Afghanistan, and so much commonality, even though there's 100 years between us.
And tell us why, you know, Brian mentioned sort of folks with firsthand experience really joining in and putting their voices out there in terms of writing about war. Why did you, is that why you started this workshop? And what do you hope to achieve with this?
Well, for me personally, I had a pretty traumatic deployment to Afghanistan. I began to use writing as a way of making sense of my experiences. But even deeper than that, I started to find that when I was talking to other people, the relationships that were developing were much more meaningful, whether it was a Vietnam veteran or a spouse of a veteran or even a civilian. I found that really at the core of war is, for the person, is trauma. And I think that on some deeply human level, we can all somehow connect to trauma. And creating this group and opening it to not just veterans but civilians allows us to really struggle with that and open a real dialogue where we can find more commonality that is outside just, say, one veteran experience.
Robert Pinsky, last word goes to you in our final minute here. Do you think the writing about war, and perhaps, if you agree with Tom, including trauma, has made the writing change?
I think that the scale of war changed everybody's imagination. The heroic idea of war as knightly was dealt a tremendous blow by our Civil War, and then in a kind of fatal blow by the First World War. And our wars nowadays involve so many civilians. The old idea of war as a duel between knightly classes is gone by the civilian casualties. When I listened to Brian read his poem, and I listened to Tom talking, I thought of the great story in today's Boston Globe. The young man who sacrificed himself in the First World War recalled his two grandfathers Civil War.
Robert Pinsky, thanks so much. Brian Turner, Tom Lasser, thanks to you as well. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.